Hey, welcome to Life 2.0 Podcast, Earth Day Edition. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Thanks for joining me on the Life 2.0 podcast from anywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. The technology that allows this to happen every time I fire up this microphone blows my mind. I kid you not. My oft-repeated theme is that I am an analog guy in a digital world. Good thing that I adapted to a greater or lesser degree that I can get this stuff done. Much like a one-man band who has to play a lot of instruments over the years in radio, I've learned the behind-the-microphone side, which came first. I was basically forced to learn the production side, otherwise the microphone side doesn't work at all, and wore a lot of hats over a lot of years, but this digital stuff has made everything a whole lot easier, I'm here to tell you. But the fact that I can be here just outside of Chicago on my trusty, dusty Dell laptop in my own studio and use this great platform called CleanFeed to create these shows, and then with some editing here and there, a couple of, smoothing of the rough spots, upload this to another platform, and that millions of people around the world have access to this by clicking a button, that is some serious shit, I'm here to tell you, in a good way. This is an Earth Day show as we come to the end of Earth Week, which, like a lot of things that humans come up with, we celebrate a day or a week or whatever, or a month. It's obviously every day is Earth Day. It's the most obvious thing in buried in the absurd that I have really ever come across. It's good that we set aside a day. It started in 1970 and it has expanded every year since. Now we call Earth Week, which is good. Maybe one day we'll get to Earth Month, and who knows, maybe Earth Year. I'm going to work without a net as usual and give you just some thumbnail sketches, pulling some file drawers open in the back of my head about some of the historical perspective here. Earth Day started in 1970, and a lot of it was in response, this upswell of Americans who said enough's enough, when the Cuyahoga River in Ohio basically caught fire because there was so much shit in there and contamination, it literally caught on fire. Never forget the paper headlines to see a river, which is water, on fire. Fire and water don't mix. In this case, it did because there's so much crap in there. That, along with a lot of other things. If you're a certain vintage like I am, you can remember pulling up at a stop sign or a stoplight and people throwing garbage out the window of their car, like just throwing out the window. I remember people dumping ashtrays out the window, and I always wondered, what the hell's this all about? We got garbage cans, but humans, for the most part, are too lazy to do those type of things. And so there was this big campaign that came around about Make America Beautiful. Can you imagine that you have to tell people to do that? But we do. So the EPA was created by Richard Nixon, who, quite frankly, was not a conservation president by any stretch of the imagination, but he was a politician and he knew votes when he could find them. And so he created the Environmental Protection Agency not long after the Cuyahoga River thing and the whole Earth Day thing was going on. So he capitalized kind of on the early ecological movement that was taking place in the country. Didn't turn out too good for Tricky Dick. Of course, there's a little thing called Watergate, but he did put it in place. And that still exists today. So that was one of the positives that came out of it. But as a kid, I remember the Earth Day celebration, 70, 71, 72, was kind of an anomaly. Like, well, what are we celebrating here? And it was in such stark contrast to Vietnam, which was going on at the same time. And you had the war protests over here. And then in April, you had this Earth Day thing over here. So it was a bit of an interesting contrast for sure. Over the years, I've been amazed at how much advancement we've made when it comes to protecting the environment, and also how much we have left to do, because the same mentality of people throwing shit out the window of their car still exists. We just don't do it in public anymore. Every now and again, I'll see somebody do that, but the mindset that it's okay to do that, I think, is really the problem. Throwing the garbage out the window is the effect. The cause is something deep inside people that somehow, somewhere, we're apart from this ecosystem as opposed to a part of this ecosystem that we live in. Everything I learned about how to take care of the planet, I learned in fifth grade at Belding School in Chicago. Mr. Andler was my science teacher. We had this, at that time, it seemed enormous, 25-gallon terrarium in our classroom. And we all took turns taking care of it and cleaning it and making sure little animals and newts and snails and other things had everything they needed. And I remember one time we went on, it was like spring vacation or something, came back, and some of the little creatures in there weren't doing so well, and somebody didn't clean it, and it got out of hand. And Mr. Andler made the case, this had to be in right around the time of the Earth Day, because I graduated eighth grade in 1973. And that was my first kind of wake-up call to, well, we're really kind of all living in a terrarium, aren't we? It's just a lot bigger. The Earth is a biosphere, and everything that is contained within the biosphere, all forms of life are affected by something else in the biosphere, for better or for worse. And that was no more apparent than that terrarium and the little suffering salamanders and things. So I learned that early on, and then not long after that, I always use this example. I've given talks over the years, many years now, 35, 40 years on the environment, but mostly coming now from a science perspective, because the science is already there. Whether people agree with it or not, can't do much about that. Science is already there. Don't want to agree with it? Don't agree with it. I tend to spend my time on the energetic aspects of the environment, for lack of a better term, the connection, the energy we have to this biosphere that we live in. And I was recalling a time many years ago where my dad, like a lot of dads, would change his oil 4 times a year in the car. Spring, summer, winter, fall, my dad, like clockwork, would change the oil. Now, this is when, you know, now it's every 3,000 miles that you're supposed to change your oil. But back then, my dad just did it. 5 quarts of oil, got underneath the car, put it up on the curb, and he would literally drain the oil from the car onto the ground and then wash it down with a hose into the sewer. My dad was a good guy, but there was no consciousness at that point about where that oil would go. And I would help my dad. You know, I love working on cars. It started working with him. And I remember asking him once, well, Dad, where's that oil go? He said, well, it just goes in the sewer. Well, where does the oil go once it goes into the sewer? He's like, well, I don't know. It just goes, you know, into the sewers. Well, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the sewers, especially back then, eventually went through some sort of filtration, rudimentary at the time, but they end up in the river. And where does the river go? River goes into the lake. So we had a roundabout conversation about oil changes in the street. And I remember asking him, but you know, he's like, well, it's just 4 times a year. And again, out of sight, out of mind, I said, well, how many dads you think are changing their oil like this? A little light bulb kind of went off my pop's head over the top of his brain there. And he made a couple changes. Eventually, the next time he did that, he got a 5-gallon can of oil, dumped all the oil out into 5 jars. I think it was like glass jars he had. Quart jars, and then he cut the top off that can and put the can underneath the car and drained the old oil into the can, which is really a huge improvement than going in the frickin' sewer. So what did he do with the old oil? Eventually, he stored it under the porch of our house. Later, a gas station started taking used oil in. Now, this is from a time that was very different. You know, there was no quickie oil lube changes places that were around at that point. If there were, I don't recall. My dad did his own stuff. Most of the dads that I knew did their own thing. There was nobody pulled in and let somebody else change their oil. It just wasn't done. That's right up there with pumping your own gas. One of my first real paying jobs was at a standard station at Broadway and Surf in Chicago, Broadway and Surf Streets. And it was quite an experience, but that's for a whole nother show. But they had all, you know, we all worked there pumping gas, leaded gas. We would walk up to the car and say regular or unleaded. So leaded gas eventually had to be phased out. Why? Because lead's not good for us. It's these type of unconscious things that have to become more conscious. And that's where I try to spend my time, wedging myself into these, you know, common sense for uncommon time opportunities. So the leaded gas thing, and now everybody pumps their own gas. You'd be hard-pressed to find a place that an attendant would come out and check your oil, pump your gas, and check your tires and wipe your windshield. Back then, it was the norm. So my point in that little bit of a rant there is it's all about consciousness. Everything's really about consciousness. Whether you're conscious or unconscious or somewhere in the middle, I think that's what it's all about. There is no science that, to me, is left unproven when it comes to the environment. Humans have an impact. Bottom line, period, end of story. Makes no sense to me to sit down and have a conversation with someone and they say, well, you know, humans couldn't possibly do any damage to the planet. It's too big. It's too old. That's the DNA of denial that lives so deep in us. It reminds me of people who smoke. My mom smoked like a fiend and, you know, it did not help her health-wise, but for a while she got away with it and eventually it caught up to her. And that's how the human mind, or the human ego, I should say, this thing that is apart from instead of a part of, keeps us off balance. I have a friend of mine who recently went through many months of cancer treatments for throat cancer because he smoked. And he admitted that he did it to himself. So it's like we get away with stuff for quite a while, and all of a sudden, you don't. And that's when it's time to pay the piper, right? Or the fiddler, or the clarinet player, or anybody else you want to stack up there. And I think that's where this always comes around. It reminds me of the movie Jaws. I talk about climate change in the terms of a great white shark, and everybody has seen Jaws, so it's a great reference point. And in Jaws, there's all these shark attacks, right? And Chief Brody knows there's a shark, but he can't tell anybody there's a shark because the mayor's like, it's bad for business. We don't want anybody to know about the shark. It'll go away. Don't worry about it. They'll go swim somewhere else. Well, after a while, the bodies start to pile up. And what happens? They got to hire Quint to kill the shark. And all along the way, the shark is churning shit up in the sea and eating people left and right. And there's a great scene in the movie where Matt Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss, walks up to the late, great Murray Hamilton, who plays the mayor. And there's a billboard that was defaced, and there's a big shark fin, and there's a young woman's picture on there screaming, help, help. And he says, Mayor, I'd like you to look at that billboard because those proportions are correct. There's a giant shark out there, and you got to pay attention to this. And the mayor says, like to prove that, wouldn't you? Get your name in the National Geographic. And the denial of that doesn't make the problem go away. It just exacerbates it. And finally, Dreyfuss walks around and says, I think you're going to ignore this particular problem until it swims up and bites you in the ass. Climate change is a great white shark. We can get away with it for a while, and it seems like everything's okay. And then it swims up and bites us in the ass. We don't know what to do about it. And then you hear on the news all the time that there are cities and towns, especially on the coastal areas, that are trying to shore up their area there, their coastline, because of erosion and the water's rising and all kind of stuff's going on. There are people in the third world countries that will take the brunt of this. So as long as it doesn't affect me here, it doesn't exist. I have a couple friends that are very close to me and we're all real tight, but we differ on this. And they'll say things to me like, well, where's the climate change and global warming when it's cold out? It's called global warming. That wouldn't mean the entire planet. There's a difference between weather and climate. These are fundamental, rudimentary questions that I don't try to explain much anymore, but it's those kind of mentalities that, to me, keep things separate. It's no different than the cigarette lobby years ago that said smoking does not cause cancer. They have this huge effort, well-funded, to derail people from smoking. And now it's on the side of a package. If you smoke these, they could kill you. People still smoke. So for me, it's a pretty cut and dry deal. And what it comes down to, what I hope to at least impart a little bit in this show, is where you might play a role in all of this. Because the most challenging thing is to see the enormity of all that's going on and feel like you can't do a damn thing about it. A few years ago, Bill Curtis and I, the vaunted and highly respected, awarded journalist Bill Curtis, we created a series of one-minute vignettes called Earth Matters. This started when I was at Harpo back in 2009, and I was doing a lot of research on different things and got pretty adept at doing one-minute programming, the short form, as we call it in the business. And I wrote three or four Earth Matters with him in mind because of his voice. And it took us 3 years or 4 years to actually get around to doing them. And then they ran in syndication around the country for a couple of years. And I have all of them here. I have well over 300 of these Earth Minutes on my computer. For every 1 minute that I created and produced and scripted and that Bill read, it took me about 2.5 hours to research the material to go into 59 seconds. And so that becomes a skill over time that I find quite amazing because I don't think I'm that smart. But anyway, somehow this comes together for me. And so I've lined up three Earth Matters to include in this show, talking points, if you will, from someone who who's been around the world and seen the effects of climate change that most of us haven't.
As long as humans transport oil in pipelines and on ships, there will always be spills. But according to one pipeline builder, oil spills might be a good thing. In 2013, a pipeline burst under the streets of Mayflower, Arkansas, flooding the area with thousands of gallons of crude oil, causing the evacuation of hundreds of families and sending people to the hospital. But according to Kinder Morgan, a pipeline builder that wants to spend $5.4 billion to triple the capacity of a line in Canada, oil spill cleanup and recovery can be an economic boon to affected communities and regions, creating jobs and helping the local economy. That analogy is akin to saying that smoking cigarettes is a good idea because it keeps money for cancer research coming in and provides jobs in laboratories. Perhaps oil companies should create jobs by investing in new energy sources instead of cleaning up after old ones. I'm Bill Curtis, and Earth Matters.
You know, you always got to follow the money trail. That's the bottom line. And when it comes to oil, it is a roller coaster. We have probably two or three more Earth Matters. We talk about the price of oil going up and down, how it affects people, what the backside of it all is. And, you know, you're at the whim of Wall Street and everything that goes out in the world, whether it's a war in Ukraine that sends prices skyrocketing, or just about a year and a half, 2 years ago, in the middle of a pandemic, they couldn't give oil away. 99 cents a barrel. Nobody was driving. So you look at the ups and downs of all that, and you realize it's almost like a puppeteer. We're all dancing at the end of a string to some degree. And the only way you can get around that stuff, number one, is stop driving. I mean, if you don't have a car, the oil prices, at least in that vein, when it comes to fuel for your vehicle, doesn't really bother you. And the opposite of that, of course, is there's more and more electronic vehicles coming out, which I find unbelievable. 10 years ago, you couldn't find a single one except Tesla, which was basically a test car. And now this year, Ford Motor Company has taken its most productive, top-selling line of trucks, the F-150, and turned them into electric vehicles. So just in a decade, the technology that is allowing this is fascinating. This is the kind of thing we can do when we go into a different direction. But you won't find that from the oil companies because it's not in their best interest to develop a car that's electric. Come on. So I look at these things and say, we're finding our way through this stuff. Is it soon enough? Is it going to be in time? I don't know. And I don't even know what that time is. You know, one of the big sticking points for me is there is some sort of misunderstanding that we're trying to save the planet. At least I don't see it that way. This planet is at least, if not more than 4.5 billion years old. You think we're the top dog here? We've only been around for about 250,000 years in this present form like we are now. In the last 150 years, with the Industrial Revolution, maybe 200 years now, we have done more damage to the environment with all the shit that we put in the air and in the water than any other species has ever come before us. And they've all left at some point. So the minute you were born, you're on your way out. And I look at us as a species, as the human species, that we're the only one on the planet that's intentionally cutting its own life source off, the planet we live on, we depend on for life. And when you argue for your limitations, you get to keep them. So for everybody who says, we can't do this, and there's denial here, and why it's cold out here, so there's no climate change, I can't help you. That just pushes me in a different direction, do things. You know, the few do the work for the many. It's always been that way. Whether they agree with you or not kind of is not relevant anymore. But I think of those type of things, and we're making some great advances. Just the concept of electric cars, which is not new. Go look at the stuff Edison was doing. He was trying to figure it out back then. But how much money is there in an electric car compared to the oil you can get out of the ground? Not much. Anyway, and I'm sure they come with their own inherent challenges, right? What are you going to do with the batteries and how do you recharge them and all that kind of stuff? But we're at least making strides in a direction that's a little bit different that should, over time, take the burden off the oil mess that we've gotten ourselves into. That's for sure. I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. I think it was called The Heart of the Sea by Ronnie Howard about, I think it's a bit of a takeoff on Moby Dick. Or something around there. It's been years since I've seen it. But at the end of the movie, they're talking about how this all came around with this big whale and stuff like that. And a guy is transcribing the experience of this other guy. And as they're getting ready to wrap up their conversation, the man says, you know, this is all going to change anyway, because I heard that in Oklahoma, they found oil in the ground, where up to that point, whale oil was used to power the world. That's why we slaughtered them, to get their oil. And the other guy who's doing the transcribing says, oil from the ground? What are we going to do with that? Uh-huh. Here's another Earth Matters. Let's see where this takes us.
The ozone layer. It's the Earth's built-in barrier that filters out UV rays from the sun. And there is some good news. For the last half of the 20th century, companies flooded the atmosphere with ozone-depleting chemicals called CFCs, mostly used in refrigerators and aerosol sprays, which led to scientists discovering a hole in the ozone layer. In 1989, the Montreal Protocol was enacted, which banned the chemical. But the damage was already done, as the process takes 30 years to cycle out. The good news is that the ozone hole has been slowly closing due to the ban. The bad news is that it could take another 30 years or more to close completely. The ozone layer is the sunscreen of the planet. It's a thin, unseen barrier that allows for protection from massive amounts of ultraviolet rays. Those who say humans cannot affect climate change have a very short memory. I'm Bill Curtis, and Earth Matters.
That's for sure. That whole Montreal Protocol thing was, I mean, to me, it is the benchmark and standard that could never be reached again. So in the late 70s, a bunch of scientists figure out that these chlorofluorocarbon CFCs are the cause of the ozone depletion. And once they figure that out, they realize that these CFCs for decades, as we just heard with Bill and talking about how it was a propellant and a refrigerant and all these different things, they had to come up with an alternative source to do that, to replace these CFCs. The manufacturers of CFCs were pissed, just like the oil manufacturers are pissed when things change. What are we going to do? You're infringing on our business. We have the right to make billions. Well, all the countries of the world got together and signed the Montreal Protocol that said no more CFCs, they're banned. Guess what? The manufacturers of those CFCs eventually found other safer propellants to use in aerosols, refrigerators, air conditioners, you name it. And we survived. You try and get something like that done now. If the same thing presented itself here in the 21st century, not in the 20th century, and said, here's what's going on. There's a hole in the ozone layer that protects us. And because of that, we're going to have more problems because we're not supposed to have a hole there. And these are the things that are causing that problem. You'd have the same, what are you talking about? I can't see it, so it doesn't exist. Bullshit going on. Just because you can't see something doesn't mean it's not there. You ever seen a baby pigeon? Well, they exist because there's big pigeons. So when I look at those type of things, in some ways we've gone backwards. Could never get the Montreal Protocol signed today. Never, 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 never. And the pivot point, interestingly enough, came from President Reagan, another guy like Richard Nixon who was not a conservation president at all. Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, was a scientist by trade before she ever became, you know, the Iron Lady. And she and Ronnie Reagan were kind of pals back in the 80s. And when all this stuff was going on, she actually did, you know, looked at the results of the testing and all that kind of stuff and got on the horn with Reagan and said, listen, Ronnie, I don't think she said it that way, but so what? You know, listen, Ronnie, this is what's going on. As a scientist, I'm interpreting these facts. And there's going to be much higher incidences of skin cancer if we don't do something and help that hole close. Ronald Reagan had skin cancer. Not a good experience for him. All of a sudden, it wasn't an abstract somewhere out there in a hole he couldn't see. It was personal. And she said, Mr. President, you have the power to make sure that other people don't go through what you have. Bing, he signs the Montreal Protocol. And when we signed, and Great Britain signed, and everybody else signed, we were good to go. But try that now? I don't think so. When I was a kid growing up, one of the most popular shows, at least for me, was The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. It was the opportunity for me to sit in Chicago and watch on a little Sears black and white television on Tuesday nights at 6:30, watch this little ship, the Calypso, bounce around the oceans of the world and go underwater. And man, You know, that's nothing now, right? But back then it was a big deal to sit there and look on my television and watch these divers go underwater and see things that I'd never seen before. It was big time stuff. And I was just grabbed by it. I became a member of the Cousteau Society. I just think that what Captain Cousteau did was just critical and important and educational in ways that has never left me. And I remember him saying a quote along the lines that you only protect what you love and we destroy what we don't understand. So learning to love this biosphere and all the elements in it, and ourselves included, has been a crucial component of the work that I've done since I got my degree in environmental interpretation and communication in 92, but I started in the 80s. And that was this environmental interpretation and communication was basically built off the work of Jacques Cousteau. He was an educator. He was a pioneer. And when he took us underwater, me for sure, here and I was in Chicago, and I was, next thing I knew, I was underwater with humpback whales and jellyfish and giant squid and sharks and all the coral reefs and moray eels. It was unbelievable. It had a lasting effect on me. Never got to meet the man. But his son, Jean-Michel, and I have been friends over the years, did quite a few radio shows together. And his work with Ocean Futures has been paramount as well. And so there are these people out in the world, as I always say, few do the work for the many, that are doing things on our own behalf without us even knowing about it. That we're taking care of business we can't take care of without them. So I have nothing but enormous respect for Captain Cousteau and his legacy, and Jean-Michel with his legacy as well, and the work that he does with Ocean Futures. Just had to do a quick shout out to him. It also gives me a chance to drop a needle on one of my favorite songs from John Denver.
Crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown, to be part of the movement and part of the growing, part of beginning to understand. You've been to things that you've shown us, the stories you tell. I Calypso, I sing to your spirit, the men who have served you so long and so well. Put a lady, put a lady, put a lady, put a lady. Like a dolphin who guides you, you bring us beside you to light up the darkness and show us the way. For though we are strangers in your silent world, to live on the land we must learn from the sea. To be true as the tide and free as a windswell, joyful and loving in letting it be. Thank you.
You know, I hear them sing that song, and I think of the times that we spent together talking about environmental things, talk about the human family and all like that. And it's hard for me to separate sometimes what I do from who I am. I know that I've had a lot of careers over my lifetime, but I've only had one calling, and the calling has been this microphone. And I think there's an enormous responsibility that comes with having a microphone and a platform, whether there's 3 people listening or 3 million. I see these headlines of these lower life forms that have been given a microphone, and you know, the stuff that goes on, I can't even look at it. It hurts my eyes. So much like the late, great Fred Rogers said about television, that the space between the viewer and the host is sacred, I think the same thing holds true for me here. Ever since I started radio on August 27th, 1997, and every show since then, the thousands and thousands of shows I've done and the thousands of shows I've produced and the books I've written, the TED Talks I've given, it's just all part and parcel of the same thing that comes back to that consciousness. Something shifted me a very long time ago, over time, but a very long time ago. Whether it was talking with my dad about that oil going into the sewer, or watching that first Earth Day and seeing that river on fire, they're somehow connected. Watching Cousteau underwater brought something alive in me that just wasn't there before that. And in the mid-80s to late-80s, connecting with John Denver, who I had listened to as a young guy growing up, and then ending up out in Aspen, Colorado, for the WinStar Choices for the Future symposiums that he would host out of there in the Aspen Music Tent. It was a glorious thing for 3 days. People from all over the world would come and say, how do we do this better? How do we figure this out? And it, great speakers and things like that, and performances like that one that John just did. And then in 1993, to be asked by John to speak there was like some sort of a stamp of validation. I was heading in the right direction. And I haven't stopped. I have faltered many times, but I've never wavered, and I'm good with that. And I think that this, at least for me, is the way that I get the chance to do something about things that, for the most part, look like can't be handled. I can't do anything about, you know, a jillion things going on in the world, but this is where I get to have my bully pulpit. This is where I get to remind myself and you that life is worth living, and that we are living on an incredible planet that is alive and vibrant, and that we are part of it, not apart from it. And if we just do that, even just do that, the appreciation to be here, as I've said in my second TED Talk, the odds of being born are 1 in 400 trillion, and you showed up. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? I'm sitting in my studio, and I have this tray of seedlings that are starting to pop up. My favorite are sunflowers, those giant ones, like 12 to 14 feet high. And one of the reasons I like to have those in the yard is because they're great bee attractors. And if there was one creature on the planet that might just be the linchpin for all that goes on, it's the bees of the world. It's the one, they pollinate the flowers, and the flowers become part of the environment. And I'll spare you the science lecture, but basically bees are one of those critical species that our lives depend on, because it's all about the ripple effect.
There are at least 20,000 known species of bees in the world. But it's what we don't know about this amazing insect that might be one of the biggest challenges we face with regard to the environment in the next 20 years. A Cornell University study estimates that honeybees annually pollinate $14 billion worth of seeds and crops in the United States. Essentially, if honeybees disappear, they could take most of our insect-pollinated plants with them. The past 6 years have brought about a condition called CCD, or colony collapse disorder, an acceleration in the annual die-off of bees that some experts believe has to do with sprayed-on pesticides. While there are big problems when it comes to long-term sustainability, it might just turn out that the bee contains our greatest chance for survival. I'm Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
You know, it's interesting for me to hear those Earth Matters with BK. Those are a few years old now. They're about 3-4 years old. But they're what we call in the industry evergreen, because the message then is the same as the message today. So they never go out of style. And I can clearly remember researching and writing that particular script for Bill and being at Curtis Productions and him in the booth doing these, and all the process that goes into producing this and then syndicating it and people listening around the world. It's a fascinating thing to watch it unfold. So to sit here these years later and hear him, I can remember being in the studio with him, which was really, really cool and quite the honor. So if there was one thing you wanted to do or could do, you could plant stuff that attracts bees. That one thing. You don't have to do everything, but you could do one thing. And you could make sure that in your yard, should you have a yard, that you can plant flowers that attract bees because of what he just said, that they're the pollinating machine of the planet. Get ready to wrap this up. There was so much I want to put in here. I'm already over time to some greater or lesser degree because as our attention spans have grown shorter, so have the messages that I've attempted to bring to the show. I'm used to doing 3 hours of radio live a day. So for me to get this under 30 minutes is getting a little bit more difficult because I have so much I like to share. But in the last few minutes, what comes to mind is a lesson that I learned from my Native American friends about the five things. And they're the five most important things when it comes to our presence on the planet. And they're in this order. First and foremost, there's the Earth itself, which is the mantle and the crust and the bones of Earth, basically, the basic Earth itself, this great stone heart. And then there's all the floral and fauna, all the green things and the brown things and the red things and the yellow things in the fall, from the great redwoods to the smallest lichen, from those flowers in your yard for the bees, you know, to the moss that grows in Ireland on the side of somebody's house, all the stuff that is green and growing. Then comes all that swims, crawls, walks, and flies, all these amazing creatures that we share this biosphere with, from the mighty blue whale to the tiniest vole that lives under the ground in your yard and everything in between. And then number four is the water, all the rivers and the streams and the ponds and the lakes and the oceans. They are basically the lifeblood of planet Earth. And real quick with the water, just in case you don't know this, we don't get any new water. It's not like the rain is new water. It goes up and comes down. It goes up and comes down. It goes up and comes down. We do not have any new water on this planet. There's never been any new water on this planet. All the same water we have now is the same stuff that dinosaurs waded in millions of years ago. It's the same water. It goes through the aquifers, and it gets cleansed on its own, and then it comes up to the surface, and it goes to the clouds, and it goes, moves over here, and drops down, and starts all over again. We don't get any new water. So if there was one thing you can do besides helping the bees out, stop drinking bottled water. Stop drinking bottled water. Get a nice filter. If you're worried about the water quality in your house, get a filter and run it through like a filter and then pour it. But bottled waters, there are more plastic bottles in the water, I think, than there are fish. And we put them there, all of us. So you got the Earth, you got the green and living things, you got the all that swim, crawls, walks, and flies, and you got the water. And finally, the fifth component are humans, you and I. Here's the big aha, kids. Those first four things, they don't need us to survive. But without them, we can't survive. And in big ways and small ways, there's something you can do on a daily basis, whether it's just appreciating, you know, the planet itself, that you have the opportunity to be here, or it's taking care of your yard a little bit. And I'm not talking about spending thousands of dollars to make your grass green, because all that stuff runs off into the sewers like the old oil did with my dad. And where does that end up? But it's just the appreciation of what we have, I think, today is really I'm trying to get that across. And to do one thing, one small thing, can make a world of difference. Thanks for listening. Until next time, be well, safe travels, keep the faith.
There's a full moon over India, and Gandhi lives again. Who's to say you have to lose for someone else to win? In the eyes of all the people, the look is much the same. For the first is just the last one, when you play a deadly game. It's about time we realize it. We're all in this together. It's about time we find out. It's all of us or none. It's about time we recognize it. These changes in the weather. It's about time. It's about changes. And it's about time. There's a light in the Vatican window for all the world to see. And a voice cries in the wilderness. And sometimes he speaks for me. I suppose I love him most of all when he kneels to kiss the land. With his lips upon our mother's breast, he makes his strongest stand. It's about time we start to see it. The earth is our only home. It's about time we start to face it. We can't make it here all alone. It's about time we start to listen to the voices in the wind. It's about time, it's about changes, and it's about time. There's a man who is my brother. I just don't know his name. But I know his home and family, because I know we feel the same. And it hurts me when he's hungry and when his children cry. I too am a father, and that little one is mine. It's about time we begin it, to turn the world around. It's about time we start to make it, the dream we've always known. It's about time we start to live it, the family of man. It's about time, it's about changes, and it's about time. It's about peace, and it's about plenty, and it's about time. It's about you and me together, and it's about time.